The rise of an American Jewish intelligentsia began with the influx of Jewish immigrants who crowded into New York at the turn of the 19th century, bringing many young people with ambitions of becoming writers and creative thinkers, as was natural for a people that ascribed the highest value to intellectual activity. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. The Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. This is about Maurice Samuel, and without attempting a hard definition, I think that I am letting the term intellectual define itself in the writers that we feature. When I began reading these thinkers as a college student, and to be honest, often bored out of my mind by uninspiring teachers, I thought of these people as street fighters, wrestling with ideas, bare-knuckled, making up the rules as they found weaknesses in the arguments of their opponents. They fought for the ideas that they championed against those whom they wanted to bring down. Very often it was in dialectical form. And they were very impressively learned, conscripting other works and other books to help them get things right, get arguments right. Now, Maurice Samuel, today's subject, is one of the most independent of all the thinkers in our series, and he's going to have something to show us, in fact, about how Jews fight and how they don't. So Moshe Samuel was born in Romania in 1895 and migrated with his parents to England when he was 6 years old, raised in an immigrant section of Manchester and educated there as Maurice Samuel. He set out on his own to New York in 1914, where he soon met and married Marie Sirkin for a day. After her father had the marriage annulled, as I recounted in the talk about her, they continued to meet and correspond over a lifetime, supporting many of the same causes, addressing the same issues, and both deeply involved in the Zionist fight for a Jewish state. But they went their separate ways romantically, and though he usually wrote in the first person, drawing on his own experience in almost every book except the novels, their liaison figured prominently only in her memoirs, not in his. So from an early age, Maurice Samuel knew that he was going to be a writer. He wrote in several genres of nonfiction and fiction, including several novels, one of them under a pseudonym. After a brief stint in the United States Army and some years working for Zionist organizations, he began in the early 30s, to earn his living as an author and as a lecturer on the Jewish circuit. He was a marvelous speaker at a time when attending lectures was a main source of adult entertainment for Jews who were eager for educational stimulation in places other than or in addition to the synagogue, because he was a frequent speaker in the synagogue. And I heard today from Nama Sandro, who is the daughter of a rabbi and who wanted to be here today, who said that when Maurice Samuel came to dinner at their home, I suppose before or after one of the talks that he was giving in her father's synagogue, she found him the wittiest just the most sophisticated person whom she had ever met. So I heard him speak myself once in my teens in Montreal, and I can understand why Cynthia Ozick recalls that in her 20s in New York, she used to follow Maurice Samuel from lectern to lectern, as she puts it, running after whatever it was I thought I might get from him. And Robert Alter, Ronald Sanders, many aspiring Jewish intellectuals of our generation found in him a model of the Jewish public intellectual, a profession that he had invented for himself. And one, by the way, which no longer exists really, may again, because of the way in which these intellectuals then entered the academy and began to teach in universities subjects of Jewish interest. So this was a time when that did not yet a possibility, and so he invented this career of a Jewish public intellectual. Now I'm going to look at three strands of his writing. The first, in his own order of importance, being Zionism and its fulfillment in the Jewish state. When Samuel came to Zionism at the time of the Balfour Declaration, the movement was just beginning to gain some traction in America. The New Palestine, the weekly organ of the Zionist Organization of America, was founded in 1919, and 5 years later, Samuel took his first trip to Israel under its auspices. His reports of that journey begin on the outbound voyage to the Mediterranean, when one of the Italian passengers, learning that he is Jewish, eagerly assures him that she feels no difference. She says, "Jews, Italians, all are the same." This disturbs him, and though he cannot frankly describe the difference to her, he explains to the readers the singularity of the Jewish people and its relation to the land of Israel. And among the rest of what he writes is this: "We are told by scientists that a man's body renews itself every 7 years. Within that period, every corporeal particle of him is shed and is replaced by alien stuff. Yet the man remains the same. How? Why? This no scientist knows. Much less does he know why the spirit which went out of Palestine, carried by that bodily nation which Rome all but destroyed, should have continued imperishable through all changes and accretions, so that I, compounded of a score of human sources, should now return to Palestine as surely as if I had left it only yesterday." Now, this is already vintage Samuel, speaking with the authority of both a historical Jew with access to the whole span of Jewish experience and insisting on the continuity of that experience in him, and as a cultured cosmopolitan who had studied science and much else. Others wrote about Palestine as visitors to a foreign land, while committed Jews treated it in terms of a private language of their national religion. Now, Samuel spoke outward about living inwardly, because he knew that Zionism still needed explanation, and he took the trouble to describe how essentially Jews belonged in the land of Israel. He takes the scientist as his interlocutor, because that was the skeptical, rational part of the moderns that he thought needed convincing. But in that same article, he also confronts the sophists, who think that the Jewish attachment to Israel is an illusion, and the grubby anthropologists who measure skulls for their evidence. He writes, "Let them keep their snouts out of our councils. And when we talk of being Jewish, not deafen us with their babble about craniums and statues, Tartars and Philistines and Egyptians. I am going to visit my home." You get it? You see, all the anthropologists are looking for this evidence. If they can't find it, then they say it was a mirage, that it's not true. He swipes them off with his hand and he says, "I am going home." And he sort of implies, just because I take the trouble to explain myself does not imply that my attachment to Israel needs any explanation. So I don't think that any American ever made the case for Zionism more persuasively and from so many angles over his lifetime. Here he writes ecstatically, holding nothing back from his joy of reunion. Jerusalem, he calls, the heart of infinity, acknowledging the many nations of the North and South, East and West, who have invested in this city without feeling its secret compulsion, save one nation alone, which among those multitudes strained its ears, caught its breath, and in startled exultation stammered something in reply, cried out, half unwitting of its own words. And what are those words? Those are the words of Psalm 126. When the Lord returned the captivity of Zion, we were as in a dream. Our mouth shall be filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Now, how very different this is from Abraham Kahn's, his first visit to Palestine, 2 years after that, in 1926, if we remember, the grudging admission of a confirmed socialist that, yes, the Jewish pioneers were making something worthwhile of this country. Very different from Samuel, who knows how little the physical city of Jerusalem in those days actually resembled the dream of Zion. But without obscuring reality, because he does describe it as it is, he frames the shabby neighborhood around the Western Wall against the majestic reality of the great temple of which it formed part, the eternal people restored to its eternal land. From that early enthusiast, Samuel evolved into a masterful polemicist and instructor, answering and anticipating all the challenges that were being mounted against the development of the Yishuv, of the Jewish community of Palestine, patiently and in terms that any fair-minded American could appreciate. He supplied the historical justification for the Jewish return to the land of Israel, legal arguments for international support that it had gotten and still hoped to get, descriptions of how the country was taking shape, and practical advantages of Jewish-Arab cooperation. The more often he visited Palestine, the more confidently he wrote about it, providing data to show, for example, what Arab farmers, whom he compares to sharecroppers, gained in prosperity and independence since the coming of the Jews. He writes, "It is an extraordinary and obvious truth that the one Jewish colony of Rehovot, south of Tel Aviv, has done more for the Fellahin of the district, or for that matter, for the Fellahin of Palestine, than all the Arab leadership." Samuel explains why the entrenched Arab leaders were bound to fear both competition from the Jews and the democratic features of Jewish society that threatened their autocratic rule. But he disputes their reasons for opposing Jewish settlement one by one. And if I were collating a book of Maurice Samuel's essays, I would call it Without Apology. He writes in a way where you never, the word apologetics just simply does not occur to you because of what he takes for granted. Now, Samuel remained no less involved with Zionism after he left his job at the Zionist organization. He was often recruited to accompany luminaries like Shmariyahu Levin and Chaim Nachman Bialik when they toured America, serving in multiple roles as their public liaison, their guide, and in the latter's case, in Bialik's case, as translator. Just as Maurice Sirkin became the American liaison for Golda Meir, Samuel became the secretary for Chaim Weizmann during his periodic visits to America, and later helped him compose his great memoir, Trial and Error. "For me," writes Samuel, "Chaim Weizmann personifies, more than any other man I have known, the best that was in the shtetl Jew, combined with the qualities of worldly greatness. And the more I ponder the mixture, the more intriguing I find it." It's interesting that that same combination of Jewish intimacy and at-homeness in the world, this is a fusion that Samuel valued in himself was one of the qualities that made him idealize Weizmann as the Zionist hero whom he would have wished to anoint as the successor to Theodor Herzl. Not Ben-Gurion, certainly not anyone else, but Weizmann. So Samuel was disappointed when the movement ejected Weizmann from presidency in 1931 and again in 1947. And this disappointment continued to rankle even after Weizmann became the first president of the Jewish state. And of course, the Weizmann Institute was named for him and built around his personality. Samuel felt the country was falling off from its promise. Writing in the early 1950s, if the Weizmann of 20 years ago had been with us today, that is to say in the early 1950s, the crisis in Israel and world Jewry would be far less sharp, the prospects of recovery more immediate. This should remind us that doubts about the direction of Israel began at its very founding. People embedded in political movements find it hard to transcend the priorities of their particular faction. And Samuel chose the centrist position that Weizmann represented between the hard socialist left and the revisionist wing of Israel's electoral politics. And that was it for him, always. That was the ideal image of Israel from which he felt that other things were a severe falling off. Now here we come to a second major strand of Samuel's writing, which may seem a total contradiction to the first, his intense involvement with Yiddish, Yiddish literature, and the East European Jewish world in which the language evolved. Part of Zionism, as many of you may know, had developed in reaction to that part of Jewishness. Ahad Ha'am, for example, one of the great Zionist thinkers and one of the great modern Hebrew writers, used the phrase Shlilat HaGola, negation of the diaspora, to express the idea that Yiddish culture and what it stood for would have to be left behind in the healthier return to Zion. Shortly after the first Zionist Congress in 1897, when the movement founded a new weekly called Der Yid, the Jew, as part of its effort to publicize and win adherence among the Yiddish masses, Ahad Ha'am grudgingly accepted the need for such a publication, but he objected to it being called Der Yid, the Jew. He did not want a Zionist paper suggesting that the Israeli Jew, the new Jew whom he envisioned, could be represented or embodied in Yiddish. There was a fierce cultural battle in which Samuel was definitely in the minority. Now, he was at the opposite side of that movement, seeing in Zionism the organic fulfillment of the Jewish people as it had evolved in the diaspora, with the return to Zion always in view. All Zionist leaders believed in the Jewish connection with the past. There's no question about that. But they meant different things by it. For Ben-Gurion, it was the direct link back to the Bible, from the Tanakh to the Palmach. For Ahad Ha'am, it was Hebraism, the Jewishness embedded in the Hebrew language that was now being reclaimed as the national vernacular. Samuel, building always on his own experience, knew that before the war, Yiddish was still spoken by about 10 million Jews, including his entire formative world. He immersed himself in Yiddish literature, building on the spoken Yiddish of his childhood and using it not just to pepper his speeches and writings with Yiddish expressions, and not just as an instrument of Zionist propaganda. Once he began to read the modern Yiddish writers, he wanted to share his excitement over them with others of his generation who had switched into English. So at a time when the Yishuv of Palestine was determined to wean Jews from diaspora culture, and when American Borscht Belt comedians were already treating Yiddish as the punchline of jokes, Samuel made familiarity and appreciation of diaspora culture an integral part of his Zionism and of American Judaism. He took pride in the genius of the language. He writes just one quotation. He's marvelous to read, by the way, in his book on Yiddish, world of Yiddish. There is a curious and charming portmanteau word in Yiddish, steitsch, which can best be described, if described at all, as an expletive of expostulation. If one Jew has told another a tall story that can be neither accepted nor denied, it is not impolite to answer with the exclamation, steitsch. In this sense, it may be tormented into English as, bless my soul, you don't tell me. Or if someone has committed a misdemeanor, as distinguished from a serious crime, he may be reproved with a somewhat distressful steitsch, which amounts more or less to, but my dear fellow, one can't do that sort of thing. Or if someone makes an unreasonable demand, you counter with an appeal to the sense of proportion, steitsch, which now becomes an ironical but not unfriendly, how did you get that way? So in this kind of semi-humorous, but my acting is not up to speed, but you get the idea. And if you are readers, you can use passages like this to great advantage. So Samuel here traces the word back to the German phrase, wie heißt's auf Deutsch, what do you call it in German, to make clear that the etymological origins of Yiddish words are no longer a clue to their living identity. The point here is that where others were going low, using Yiddish to show how far they had gone beyond it, Samuel went high, praising this vernacular as one of the most remarkable creations of the Jewish people in the European phase of its exile. Now, as the most sought-after Jewish translator into English from French, German, and Hebrew, he concentrated mostly on Yiddish. The fiction of I.J. Singer and Sholem Asch, he translated more or less as written, and many of these books, of course, became bestsellers, taking liberties whenever he felt that the English reader needed an extra phrase or two to make the sentence comprehensible. Now, this was also the advice that he gave to me when I went to see him about the first work of translation that I had undertaken. I wanted to know how to translate a word, and he astonished me by saying, no, you can't translate that word. What you have to do is that you have never to resort to a footnote or to a glossary or to anything that would interrupt the reader's enjoyment, and instead unobtrusively blend the necessary information into the text. Needless, you know, I never did that. I'm of a different generation. Total respect for the text, you know. Very often I think that he was right in this. But anyway, some writers, the Yiddish masters, I.L. Peretz and Sholem Aleichem, inspired him so much that he was inspired to invent a new hybrid form of interpretive translation that weaves a new tapestry from the stuff of their fiction. He writes, it is useless to present the reader with a body of translations and say, there you have the man, judge for yourself. Sholem Aleichem and Peretz must be interpreted. One must talk about them and around them and around the people and its problems. One must retell their stories. One must hint and allude, interpolate, digress, find analogies. Their work must be introduced as if it were incidentally and by the way of illustration, even though it is actually the purpose and constitutes the bulk of the enterprise. Now, I will say that this presented me with a real problem when I began teaching Yiddish literature. There weren't that many translations, but I did not feel that the best stories of Peretz and Shalom Aleichem needed any more intervention than those of Chekhov. I would point out to students that the title of Samuel's book on Peretz, which we used, of course, Prince of the Ghetto, was misleading. Peretz, who worked for the cemetery division of the Jewish community of Warsaw, was very far from a prince, and the 300,000 Jews of Warsaw were one-third of the population with no ghetto in sight before the Nazi invasion. And it was equally misleading to claim, as Samuel did, in the world of Shalom Aleichem, that Shalom Aleichem gave us, quote, the mirror of Russian Jewry, because the very same claim had been made for his predecessor and mentor and very different writer, Mendel Amircher Sforim. Yet, I have to say that even as I made these qualifications and tried to teach standalone versions of the stories, I recommended Samuel's books to the students as among the finest available interpretations of these writers, and so they remain. Samuel was always looking for the holistic essence of the Jewish people, and he wanted others to see in these two writers, in these two splendid writers, the same embodiment of Jewishness that he had found in them. Now, this brings us to the third strand of Samuel's thinking, the distinctiveness of the Jewish people. And that goes back to the Italian woman who reassures him that all people are alike and with whom he disagrees on that point. The eventful 1940s inspired many books and commentaries on what Jews really were and were not. Rabbis and prominent authors defined Judaism for their fellow Americans. Milton Steinberg in Basic Judaism, Philip Bernstein in What the Jews Believe, Herman Wouk in This Is My God, Sholem Ash in What I Believe. Will Herber created a tripartite idea of religion in America in his very influential book, Protestant Catholic Jew. Now, very recently, literary scholar Rachel Gordan, in a book called Postwar Stories, How Books Made Judaism America, describes this as part of a larger effort to uproot anti-Semitism that included novels, films, dramatic productions, various forms of high, low, and middlebrow culture. While some of these analyses try to normalize Judaism as part of the country's Judeo-Christian foundation, and most of the novels represented them as fundamentally like all their other fellow Americans, Samuel insisted on the uniqueness of the Jewish people as part of the exceptionalism of America itself. He makes this case in his most ambitious book, The Gentleman and the Jew, that sets up a radical opposition between the code of competition and conflict, which is a legacy from the Greeks, according to him, versus the code of morality that derives from the Hebrew Bible. The first-person narrative as an approach to history is always in danger of substituting a particular story for the much larger and ultimately truer story that needs to be told. Here it is the opposite. Maurice uses his own development to demonstrate his overarching thesis about the difference between Jew and non-Jew. He begins with growing up in a home and among Jews grateful to have reached their island of refuge. And, quote, the homage that my elders paid to England's greatness was a pallid thing compared to the blazing loyalty that was awakened in me. A scholarship boy in the British school system who experiences very little prejudice and much encouragement, he identified with the British ideas of greatness, valor, and goodness. He writes, I suppose cricket comes closest to summing it all up. The impact of that word on us youngsters, the little Romanian Jewish immigrants who became little Englishmen, was overwhelming. A thing that wasn't cricket was, of course, shocking and shameful. But these adjectives do not convey the force or flavor of the condemnation. That it was not cricket did not simply mean that it was morally wrong. Something deeper was involved. Now, that something deeper was the code of being a good sport, with a British stiff upper lip, honoring fair competition on a level playing field. He was enthralled to find those values upheld in Shakespeare's historical plays, in Kipling's verse. Moreover, he finds these ideals in the best of Western civilization, in Machiavelli's ideas of the prince, in Castiglione's model of the courtier, and Plato's vision in the Republic of the godless state. When it first occurs to him that these values of honorable combat conflict with the values of humility being taught in Hebrew school, he is at first critical of his home life for falling short of British standards. As the adult thinker takes over from the boy, he changes course and becomes increasingly critical and more aggressive until the analysis turns into condemnation of the whole culture of cricket. He writes, "The gentleman is the noblest ideal of man possible in a society that immorally accepts competition and rivalry as the basis of life." He concludes that this is pagan, or again, that one man can kill another man in combat on a high level of mutual regard is perhaps the most fantastic and perverse notion that has ever sprung from the human brain. Do you see how bracing it is to read Maurice Samuel? I mean, this is in prose and in confidence, right? He gives a very harsh summary of his finding. He writes, "The theory of the inevitability of war between groups and individuals has as its unadmitted but inescapable corollary the view that life is an immoral thing. And if life is an immoral thing, the preservation of it is immoral, for it is immoral to breed killers, even if they are intended to destroy an immoral world." He writes, "The difference I was beginning to perceive between the Jewish and Gentile traditions sets the Jews apart in the world. The longer I thought about it, and it has been my chief preoccupation since my boyhood, the clearer and more meaningful did the division become. Today, I would accept Mordechai Kaplan's definition of Judaism as a civilization if it went further and stated that there are only two conceivable ideals as civilizations, the Jewish and the non-Jewish. And I use the word Jewish in its widest sense to include Christianity. The fateful difference lies in their concept of the moral problem." Samuel is not trying to be original. If Mordechai Kaplan or Chaim Weizmann have captured the idea, if Peretz and Sholem Aleichem embody it and tell it better, he promotes their conceptions in formulating his own. Because he is working everything out for himself, the conclusions that he reaches appear to be the inevitable conclusions of authentic Jewish experience. Jews alone are a nation with a moral purpose. His biblical proofs of this are as powerful as those of our best modern rabbis. Now, it's fascinating to see how Samuel's insistence on the dichotomy between the Jew and the pagan gentleman in the first part of the book becomes an insistence on overcoming the separation between the we and they when it comes to maintaining of the unity of the Jewish people after the creation of Israel. His comprehensive portrayal of Jewish civilization includes everything: interpretations of the Bible, where it all begins, incisive chapters on Jewish history, where we prove our staying power, analyses of anti-Semitism, which are very good, all of which culminate in a short shared idea of destiny of the diaspora and the newly established Jewish state. He builds the case on his own fully developed and integrated sense of himself as a Yiddish-speaking, European-born, British-educated, naturalized, American Zionist. Indivisible. By 1950, when this book was first published, Samuel, no longer a young romantic, was already soberly mindful of the many problems facing Jews in post-war America. To bring but one example of that he brings in this last chapter, trying to prove the unity of the Jewish people, he sees how easily the help that American Jews must provide in the maintenance of Israel as the common homeland of the resurrected Jewish nation, how quickly that could become interference and subvert Israel's democracy if its political parties sought help from their political counterparts overseas. For it will be noticed, he writes, that the cry, hands off, always has a party basis. The laborites in Israel do not tell the labor Zionists in America to stop interfering. And the religious Zionists in Israel do not resent the activities of the American Mizrahi. The similarities between such interference then and now show us how important it is to know what has already been written on the subject. Any thesis that was as big and bold as this about Jew and Gentile and the radical dichotomy between them, and the last part of the book, all of this was bound to have its critics. And actually, I share the qualms of literary scholar David Deitches, who was raised in Scotland under circumstances similar to Samuel's, and who points out in his review of the book, drawing on his own intellectual development, that some moral struggle and traits of the gentleman are not pagan at all, but Judeo-Christian, and that Jews have their own traditions of competition and honor. And he points out, if you've ever been in a yeshiva culture, the kind of, elbowing and proving yourself to be better than and in a search for a good rabbinate and so on and so forth. In other words, he points out that the same kinds of competition exist among the Jews in their own sphere. In any case, I happen to worry, and I worried back then, as enamored as I was of this book the first time I read it, I worried that Samuel mistakes as Jewish values some of the adjustments to powerlessness and poverty that Jews were forced to make after losing their homeland. The idea that warfare is innately immoral contradicts whole sections of the Bible and can be especially dangerous for the Jews who are the target of too many enemies to count. But Maurice Samuel also taught us to read him in a critical spirit, embracing all that still holds true in him. You have not seen a takedown of anti-Semites until you read him expose historian Arnold Toynbee, who called Jews a fossil people, or novelist Theodore Dreiser, who writes about the Jews. You don't know how engaging literary criticism can be until you read Samuel on the Jewishness of Marcel Proust, Saul Bellow, and James Joyce. Samuel remains one of the most bracing thinkers of the American Jewish intelligentsia, a model of how to think among the nations. Maintaining a distinctive culture is the greatest challenge to American Jewry, and Maurice Samuel paved the way. And I perhaps end with, I don't know why this particular passage, one could choose almost any, but just to hear him in his own voice. I am perplexed and fascinated by the changes in the essential peculiarness of the Jews, by its enrichment throughout the ages, by the question of the Jewish attitude towards it. When the Jews first conceived themselves to be a peculiar people in biblical times, they claimed an exclusive relationship to God and to his laws and revelations. Yet this was only a relative peculiarness. Every people had an exclusive relationship to its gods and to their laws and revelations. When the God of the Jews and his laws and revelations became the heritage of the Western world, the Jews achieved, paradoxically enough, a higher peculiarness. They were pointed out as the precursors and rejectors of universal salvation. They said, that was not what we meant. Then they reached their true or inner peculiarness, but to challenge to say what they meant, they lost themselves in arguments and texts. This last and true peculiarness of the Jews, the highest and richest, could not be the subject of a universal discourse. It was and is a peculiarness of personality, describable in its origins and effects, but not transmissible as doctrinal statement. So, this is very challenging. One can read it again, but it will still say the same thing. Namely, this peculiarness is something that is real, essential. It is something that we must acknowledge, but to try to define it in some way that can please anyone else outside, he feels is not doable, essentially. So explaining up to a point that we are peculiar, absolutely. And how, perhaps, also, but turning it into some kind of doctrinal essence, he rejects that possibility. So I think really extremely intriguing and, if I may say, very American, right? Very American, very free, very American, and written at a time, you can just see, written at a time when he was sure that you could say anything and it would please a great many people, and did. So, thanks.